You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
I'm excited about a chance to begin to open and look at a new book of the Bible together, the book of Exodus. But before we do, I want to mention a diagram to me, to you, that was shown to me for the first time just a few years ago. And it's actually a diagram that I think is really helpful in understanding how the Bible works and really how the entire Christian life works. If you look at it, I printed it there on page 4 under the preaching of the word. It's a real simple diagram with two axes. If you look at the horizontal axis, it just says belief and behavior. Oftentimes, this is how we primarily understand the Christian life, right? It's a set of beliefs that lead to a certain type of behavior, a certain way of living, a certain code of ethics. In fact, our larger culture would probably define Christianity this way. They would say a Christian is someone who believes these things and lives in this way. They do this and they don't do that. And Christianity is certainly not less than that, right? The Bible, when you read it, it presents to us things to believe. We call them doctrines, truths, things that are true about God, about us, about the way life works. And then the Bible actually begins, those beliefs lead to a way of living. So the Bible is not meant primarily just to give us information, but to change the way we live. And so that's an accurate way to think about the Bible and Christianity. But if it's the only way we think about it, then Christianity and the Bible sort of gets really flat, like that horizontal axis. It just becomes, over time, words on a page, like things to believe, things to do and not do, and that's it. And honestly, that doesn't captivate us for very long. Because honestly, that doesn't capture the beauty, the adventure, the pain at times of what it means to be created as a human being in the image of God. If we just think about the Bible in that way, it can miss the drama of redemption. If the Bible is only beliefs and only behaviors, then God honestly can seem kind of boring, the very thing that he is not. And that's why we need that vertical access. If you look at it, it's story at the top and then symbol at the bottom. We need that understanding to help us understand how the Bible and the Christian life works. Because it tells us that the Bible and the Christian life, and Kendall's already mentioned this, is primarily a story. It's a comprehensive narrative of God's work in the world. And it's made up of people and places and things and events. And as the story rolls along, certain aspects of the story begin to accrue significant meaning or symbolic value. And so things and people and places begin to take on meaning and symbolic value in the larger story. And so we see things like trees and wind and lambs and blood and bread take on greater meaning than themselves, right? We see places like Jerusalem or Babylon that have symbolic value in the story that are greater than their bare geography would point to. We see people like Moses or King David who are actual characters in the actual story. They're real people, and yet they're symbolic of greater things. So David is a real character in the story, and yet he is symbolic of God's promise to fulfill his promises through a monarchy, through a God king. And so David reminds us of the kingdom of God. I think it makes sense when you think about it that God would choose to unfold his word primarily in narrative, because that's really how we're made as people. Like, the thing that really grabs us, the thing that captures our hearts, is stories and the symbols that go along with those stories. I think an example of this in a fictional story is, you know, stories are things that they sort of invite us in. They say, hey, come inhabit the story and begin to participate in them. And a fictional story that we've seen in our culture for years and years and years now that does this is the Star Wars story, right? I can't believe how long the Star Wars story has been around in our culture. Like, just last Monday, if another person said, "May the Fourth be with you," right, I was going to punch somebody, right? Because the Star Wars story is always in our face. It keeps on giving. When I was growing up, people in my generation, we played with lightsabers out in the front yard. when we were kids, because we wanted to enter in, we wanted to inhabit the story. We wanted to play a part. And just this week, I saw a little boy in our church, saw a photo of him on Facebook. He had a Darth Vader mask on. He had a lightsaber, and he's saying bye to daddy as daddy goes off to work, right? You're my father, is what he was saying. And I was just like, Star Wars just spans the generations, right? It keeps on giving. It's this story that gets retold, relived, reenacted, mostly by kids, hopefully only by kids. If you're an adult reenacting this story, you need to stop that. Same for Trekkies. Sorry. The Star Wars story, we all know the general plot. Even if you don't know the details, we all know how it works because the characters, the plot, the symbols have so pervaded our culture, haven't they? Like Yoda is a character in the story, and yet he's also a symbol. If I said to you, you know what, he's the Yoda of commercial real estate in this town, you all know what I mean. Like he's the master. He's Yoda. And so we get that that's how stories work. They invite us in. Now, the biblical story is this broad, sweeping narrative that spans really from eternity to eternity. We talk about this narrative, this meta-narrative, all the time at Providence. Here's how it goes. Creation, fall, redemption, recreation, or consummation. And that is the larger story of how the Bible unfolds. And yet in that larger story, there's tons of smaller stories. And those smaller stories are filled with tension and unfaithfulness and heroes and rescue and faithfulness and despair and hope. They're filled with all sorts of things. And those stories begin to define and reinforce our beliefs and our behaviors. Those stories give us symbols that help us remember the larger story and then actually help us participate and come into the story, don't they? See, symbols have a way of bringing our beliefs and our identities into visibility so that we might see them. Communion, I think, is a great example of this. Bread, we understand, and wine in the biblical story begin to take on greater value. And then in communion, bread and wine are offered to us. And then when we take them, they begin to define and bring into visibility what we believe and who we are and how we live as a people. And so the whole diagram works together in concert, doesn't it? What we believe, and that's those dotted lines that point together, what we believe and who we are flow out of the dominant story that defines us and the symbols that signify that story. It's a great way to understand it. Tom Wright, who's a theologian, he says that human life is grounded in and constituted by the implicit and explicit stories we tell ourselves or one another. He says stories are more foundational and fundamental to our knowing than our beliefs are. In other words, how do we know stuff? Like, how do we deep down know stuff in our gut? Mostly through stories. Because that's what gets into us. That's what changes our heart and begins to form us at an identity level. So, Deuteronomy 6, look at that text that Brandon read a few minutes ago. It's an example of how this works. Deuteronomy chapter 6, it's also a good parenting text. So I thought it was good for Mother's Day. Moses in Deuteronomy 6 is talking to the people of Israel right before they go into the promised land. And this is what he says, Deuteronomy 6 verse 20. Moses says to the Israelites, hey, in the future, when your son asks you in time to come, what is the meaning of these testimonies and these statutes and these rules that the Lord our God has commanded you? So in the future, when your son or your daughter asks you about the horizontal axis, like why do we believe these things? Why do we behave or live in this way? Why do we go to church? Like, why do we give some of our money away? Why do we pray for our enemies? Why do we ask each other for forgiveness? When your son or your daughter asks you that, Moses says in verse 21, then you shall say to your son, son, let's look at Grudem's systematic theology. I've got some stuff to unfold. You know, I want you to see the five theories of the atonement. Son, let's go back through the creeds because obviously you're not getting this. No, what he says is, when your son or your daughter asks that, tell them a story. And actually, he's going to say, tell them the story. Verse 21, Then you shall say to your son, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Tell him this story, and the story starts in a shameful, embarrassing way, doesn't it? Son, we were slaves. We were owned by another people. We were helpless. We couldn't do anything for ourselves. That was our identity. But then God, our God, Jehovah, Yahweh, the God, brought us out. Verse 22. And the Lord showed signs and wonders, great and grievous, against Egypt and against Pharaoh and all his household before our eyes, meaning we saw it, meaning God went to work on Pharaoh with powerful signs and wonders. See, Pharaoh thought he was God. Son, we thought Pharaoh was God. Everybody thought Pharaoh was God, but then God just went to work, just wham, 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 wham. And Yahweh saying, no, Pharaoh's not God. I'm God. But we saw this happen. It was amazing. But that's not all. Verse 23. And he brought us out from there. Why did he bring us out? That he might bring us in. Isn't that amazing? He brought us out, not as an end in itself. He brought us out that he might bring us in and give us the land that he swore to give to our fathers. God didn't just rescue us out of something. He saved us into something, into a life of flourishing with himself at the center. But that's not all. Verse 24, and the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as we are this day. He didn't just save us out to save us in. He also gave us his word. He came down on the mountain. Moses was up there. He came down. We saw all this going on, and he gave us his good law. He told us by his word how we are to relate to him, how we're to relate to one another. Why? For our good, so that we could live, so we could flourish. And then verse 25, the last verse, and it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to do all this commandment before the Lord our God as he has commanded us. So son, that's why we believe these things. That's why we behave like this. See how that works? When your son asks you about the vertical axis, tell him about, or the horizontal axis, tell him about the vertical axis. Tell him a story. Moses is saying in this text, tell the next generation the story of Exodus. Like, that's what they need to know. They need to know the Exodus story because that's who we are. That defines us. Because God redeemed us, we are forever different. See, the Exodus story is the redemptive story of the Old Testament. It is the gospel story of the Old Testament. And Moses says, tell them that story. And he just sums it up there for us in Deuteronomy 6. We are, as a church, embarking today on this journey through the book of Exodus. We've spent months and months in the book of Romans, and it's been awesome. Romans, you might say, is the New Testament sort of systematic thesis that explains the glories of the gospel. Right? Romans falls more on that horizontal axis, what we believe and how we behave. That's actually how Romans breaks down. Romans 1 through 11 is what we believe about the gospel. Romans 12 through 16 is the way we live in light of the gospel. But today we're entering into Exodus, and Exodus, on the other hand, is a story. It's not an explanation. It's not an explanation like Romans of how salvation works. It's a description of what salvation looks like. And so we're going from this theological masterpiece in Romans to this storytelling masterpiece in the book of Exodus. And I want to invite you personally to begin reading that story for yourself some over the summer. And beginning to sort of immerse yourself in it and allow it to shape your understanding and your beliefs and how you understand who God is and how he works. I just wanted, for a few minutes today, give sort of a brief introduction to say a few things about what kind of story Exodus is. I don't have time really to say much about any of these, but I think it's helpful when you come to a narrative in the Bible to know what type of story it is, what kind of story it is, and it helps you approach it more accurately and to get more out of it as you encounter God there. And so what kind of story is Exodus? And the first thing I want to say about it is that it's a true story. Exodus is a true story. And there's still, you see stuff in the media and it makes you wonder. This is a true story, meaning it's historical. It's not a myth. It's not a fable. It's not a folktale. It's not a metaphor of how salvation works. It is a true story. One of our core convictions as Christians is that salvation takes place in the real world, right? Like, God created a real world with real people, and those people fell into real sin that had real impact. Like, real death and brokenness and pain came from that. And so if salvation is actually going to be salvation, then it needs to take place in the real world. If salvation is going to actually be salvation, it has to deal with the concrete realities of what it means to be a human being alive on planet Earth. Like, salvation is not abstract. Right? It doesn't just take place in the realm of ideas or in some other dimension. Salvation is historical, and that's what we see in Exodus. If you have a Bible, look at Exodus chapter 1. Flip over to the left from Deuteronomy to Exodus chapter 1. It's the second book in the Bible, just after Genesis. I want you to see these first few verses. The story of Exodus begins in the middle of a story that's already up and running. In fact, in Hebrew, the first word of Exodus is the word "and." Because, you know, it's just picking up where Genesis left off, "and." It's a continuation. It's not there in your English translation, but it's there in the Hebrew. So I'll just add it. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. "And these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt from Jacob," or with Jacob, "each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly, and they multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them." And so as we read this right away, it sounds like an account that's historical, doesn't it? Like, these are actual names of real people. They're all part of one family, this extended family. They're all part of Jacob's family, and they find themselves in Egypt. Now, how did they get to Egypt? You got to go back in Genesis. Remember in Genesis 35, God comes to Jacob and says, "Hey, I'm changing your name. Your name is now Israel. And great nations are going to come from you. Kings are going to come from you." And Jacob, or Israel, has 12 sons. His favorite son is Joseph. He loves Joseph. And that makes the other brothers really jealous of Joseph. And so what they do is they sell him into slavery. Right? So if you think your kids don't get along, Jacob's kids did not get along. They sold one of them. Right? They sell him into slavery. He ends up in Egypt in slavery. And then he ends up in prison in slavery, prison in Egypt. And then all of a sudden, because God is with him and working in his life all through it, Jacob is actually promoted within Pharaoh's kingdom, and he becomes Pharaoh's right-hand man. And God uses Joseph's wisdom and Joseph's, really, his ability to do strategic planning to save Egypt from 7 years of famine. Now, Jacob and his sons end up going to Egypt during the time of famine because that's where the food is, and they don't want to starve to death. And so God preserves this little fledgling nation of Israel, saves them through Joseph, a son who had been sold into slavery. God preserves them. And they're just a little fledgling nation. They're not really a nation at that point. They're just a little dysfunctional family of 70 people. But it says that they're fruitful. They multiply. They fill the land with Israelites. They are being faithful to God's mandate from Genesis 1, right? Genesis 1, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. They're doing that. But then Joseph dies, his brothers die, that whole generation dies, and something happens. Look at verse 8. "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." This new king is like, I don't even know who Joseph is. This is problematic because politics is all about who you know. It's all about connections. It's all about representation. And over time, Israel found itself without representation in Egypt. And that representation eventually led to their oppression and their subjugation, right? And it sets the stage for the Exodus. Exodus begins when Israel was just in the beginning. And God had brought Israel to Egypt to save them. Now God needs to bring them out of Egypt in order to save them. And the stage is set for the Exodus. Exodus is a true story. It's about a real people that needed real salvation. And the salvation that God accomplishes for them in this story, it actually becomes their defining story for the rest of their existence. In fact, as you know, you'll see that in chapter 12 that Israel changes their calendar. And they make the month of the Exodus their first month. They said, this is going to be the first month of the year for us, because it's so significant what God does in the Exodus. In their songs and in their worship, the themes of Exodus begin to just permeate their worship. You read the Psalms, and the Exodus is all over the Psalms. And then year after year after year, they rehearse and they commemorate the Exodus by celebrating the Passover, which is a feast, a festival, a meal, celebrating what God has done and how it's formed them. That's their story. It's a true story. If Exodus is not a true story, then Israel's history is really a sham. Right. And Christianity, the foundation which the apostles and Jesus have himself gave us to build our faith on, then we've really built it on a myth, if Exodus is not a true story. And if Exodus is not a true story, it really has no claim on our lives in any real way. Like, you don't have to believe in nor obey the God of Exodus if it's not real, right? If it's not a true story. I think one piece of compelling evidence to the truth of this story is how unflattering it is toward the Israelites. Really, most of the Old Testament is unflattering to the Israelites. If you were making up your own story, you were writing your own history, you would want to make yourself look a little bit awesome, wouldn't you? I mean, you would want to do some creative editing. You would not want to make yourself look bad. There's a Jewish biblical scholar named Nahum Sarna. He says, the Exodus cannot possibly be fictional. No nation would be likely to invent for itself and faithfully transmit century after century after century such an inglorious and inconvenient tradition. So in the beginning, Israel is just this dysfunctional family that becomes slaves. And then even after God saves them, they're like complainers, they're whiners, they're idolaters, they're fearful, they're unfaithful. They're not the hero of their own history. You wouldn't write a history like that where you're not the hero. But they're not, because God is the hero of their history. And which brings us to the second thing about Exodus. It's not only a true story, it's a story about God. It's a story about God. And as you begin to read it, keep that in the forefront of your mind. That Exodus, God is not just the author, he is the primary character. He's the main character of the story. He is the hero. He gets the glory. In fact, God's glory is the whole point of the Exodus story. God says to Pharaoh in chapter 9, he says, Pharaoh, for this purpose I've raised you up, to show you my power so that my name may be proclaimed in all the earth. In other words, what's going to happen in Exodus is so that God's name would be proclaimed everywhere. So Exodus is about the glory of God from beginning to end. Like in the beginning of the story, in chapter 3, Moses encounters God in this burning bush, and God says, I'm God of your fathers, Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. And you know what it says in chapter 3? It says Moses hid his face because he couldn't even look at God, because the very person and the very name of God is glorious. In chapter 15, in the middle of the story, after the Israelites have crossed the sea on the Red Sea on dry land, the Israelites sing a song, and this is what they sing. The Lord has triumphed gloriously. The horse and the rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. So God's deeds, his acts are glorious. His saving acts are glorious. And he reigns as the glorious king. And then at the end of the story, the very last chapter, chapter 40, the tabernacle is built. And it says this in chapter 40, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent because of the glory of the Lord. Moses is like, I can't even get in there because it's filled with the glory of the Lord, because the presence of the Lord is glorious. Exodus is a story about the glory of God. It's a historical account, but it's a theological history. When you read this story, you begin to see who God is, what he's like, what he does. We read this story and we learn that God is I Am. He's the eternally existent one. We read this story and we learn that God hears, God remembers, God sees, God knows. We learn that God redeems his people. We learn that God fights for his people. We learn that God is king over history and king over nature. He's the real Pharaoh, the real king. We learn that God provides, God guides. We learn that God is holy, God judges, God disciplines. We learn that sometimes God is silent and sometimes God speaks. We learn that sometimes God conceals himself, and sometimes God reveals himself. We learn that God gives law. We learn that God gives grace. We learn that God dwells on high, and yet God dwells down low in the midst of his people. We learn that God saves his people in every way. He delivers them out of slavery into a life of flourishing with himself at the center. Now listen, I could show you all these things in a systematic theology book. Right? I could show you doctrinal statements and creeds and say, this is what we believe about God. Or we could read a story together where God is at work, doing what God does and being who God is. And then, if you allowed that story really to get into your life, you would begin to see and to taste and to touch who God is. And if it really began to get into your life, it began to form you and shape you at a belief and behavior level, wouldn't it? The vertical axis would begin to affect the horizontal axis in our life. I want to invite you to read the story some this summer. I would say, in your devotional time, see if you can, over the 3 months of the summer, read it a few times. It's 40 chapters long. If you just read 3 chapters a day, you'd finish Exodus in about 2 weeks. Do you guys have this? I think you do. Check this out. This Exodus overview, I think, is really helpful. This is a great tool to have with you as you read. We'll also post it online so you can have it there. This is like the Google Maps of Exodus, right? You can zoom out and see the big picture, or you can zoom in and see what's happening in each of the chapters. And I want you just to notice that this is a story of God, because if you zoom out and see the three big sections, God is the subject of each of the three big sections, right? He's the one acting. So in chapters 1 through 18, God redeems his people. Chapters 19 through 24, God makes a covenant with his people. Chapter 25 through 40, God dwells with his people. God, it's a story about God. And let me just say this. When you get to chapter 25, trust me on this, you're going to be tempted to peter out and stop reading. Right? You're going to be like, all right, story's over. Back to chapter 1. And that's because it's going to start talking about tabernacle furnishings and priestly garments, and you're going to be like, I can't be reading this. I want to encourage you to press on and catch the bigger picture of what God is offering in this section. Because what God is saying in this last section is that I am the Almighty God who just conquered the most powerful empire and army on planet Earth. I'm the God who dwells in unapproachable light. I'm the king over creation. I rule over nature. And I am making a way for me to draw near to you. I am making a way for you to be in my presence and for me to dwell in the midst of our people. Right? So don't get caught up in the minutiae of priestly garments and lampstands and stuff like that and miss what God is saying. I want to dwell in the middle of my people. It's awesome. All right? Read this story. It's a true story. It's a story about God. Third thing I'll say about it is it's a story about Christ. It's a story about Christ. This is really important. When you read a book like Exodus, God has always been at work in and through his Son. Everything in the Bible points to and culminates in Jesus Christ. Oftentimes when you read a story, there's the text of the story, in this case Exodus, and it's a true story, and then there's this subtext underneath. There's a second level of the narrative. And anytime we read an Old Testament narrative, we need to be looking for where Jesus is in the subtext, at the second level of the narrative. Where does this point to Jesus? And this is where I think that it's helpful to think about the symbols in the story of Exodus. If you remember the vertical, the story symbol axis, there's lots of things that begin in Exodus that begin to accrue symbolic meaning as the story rolls along, and those symbols find their ultimate meaning in Christ. That's what they're pointing us to. So as an example, Moses. Moses is a real character. He's a real person. The story's about him on the first level of the text. But second level, Moses is symbolic of what it means to be a great prophet and a great deliverer. And we would say that Jesus is the greater Moses. He is the greatest prophet. He is the greatest deliverer. The Passover lamb was slain that God's people might be saved, and yet that lamb becomes a symbol where Jesus is the greater Passover lamb slain for the sins of the world. Bread comes down from heaven. We see the manna come down to feed God's people, and then we're reminded that Jesus is the bread who came down from heaven. He's the bread of life. And he said, partake of me that you might have life. Right? Moses goes up on the mountain to get the law, and then he brings it down. We see Jesus in Matthew 5 go up on a mountain and say that that law that Moses brought down is fulfilled in me. It's great stuff. Moses gets at the end, in that section I said that's going to bore you, Moses gets the instructions for the tabernacle, right? So that God can dwell in the midst of his people. Jesus is called in John 1, the Word made flesh who tabernacled among us. He is the tabernacle. God makes his dwelling in the person of Jesus. It is a story about Jesus. There's so many symbols, and we find their ultimate meaning in Christ. If you think about it, our two Christian sacraments are symbols, baptism and communion, they are symbols that connect us not only to Jesus, but further back, they connect us to the Exodus story. It's really cool. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, listen to what Paul says. This is awesome. Paul is talking about the Exodus story in 1 Corinthians 10. He says, our fathers were all under the cloud, and they all passed through the sea. So in Exodus, God's leading his people around with a pillar of cloud during the day, and he leads them through the Red Sea on dry land. He says, our fathers were all under the cloud, they passed through the Red Sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And they all ate the same spiritual food, and they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Isn't that amazing? Paul is interpreting the Exodus story through the language of our sacraments. Like in baptism, we pass through the waters. We are miraculously delivered from harm, and we come up from the water on the other side, safe in the arms of God. Like we come up out of the waters as new people. So in one sense, we're the same people, we're the same person, and yet in another sense, we are forever changed because of the story that we've entered into. God has redeemed us, and our greatest enemies can never enslave us or capture us again. That's baptism. In communion, we partake of the greater Passover lamb who was slain. We're covered by his blood. We eat from the bread of heaven. We drink what only he can provide. And when we do, Christ is actually spiritually present with us in the same way that he was spiritually present with them. That rock was with them, feeding them, nourishing them, refreshing them, providing for them in the wilderness. It's pretty cool. And it makes sense, I think, that the sacraments would connect us to the Exodus. Because the Exodus is not only a true story, it's not only a story about God. It's not only a story about Christ, but the last thing I'll say is it's a story about us, right? It's our story. It is the story of the Christian life. When you read it, you're not only reading a history of how God worked to save the Israelites, you're actually reading how God stepped into history, and it's a paradigm or a pattern of how God stepped into history to save you and me. Because we were in bondage, weren't we? We were in slavery to sin and death, and we needed to be set free. And God brought us out of slavery with a mighty hand, right? Through the blood of a slain lamb. And that blood covered us. That blood marked us. That blood saved us. But God not only saved us out of slavery, he saved us into relationship with himself. He made a covenant with us. He bound himself to us as his God, as our God. And he gave us his word. To lead us, to tell us how to relate to him and to one another. And he made a way to worship him, to draw near to him. And he promised us, and this is our hope, that we would have life in an eternal promised land, the new heavens and the new earth. And so our story is directional. God is leading us somewhere, just as he was leading the Israelites when he led them out of slavery. This is our story. Exodus is about you and me. Israel told and retold and retold and retold so the Exodus story so much, so many times, that it was woven into the fabric of their imagination. Those are the words of Eugene Peterson. It was woven into the fabric of who they are, their imagination. They rehearsed the story in their worship, in their festivals, in their community life. They retold it again and again. It was the story for them. It was their identity story. We were slaves, but God brought us out that he might bring us in. Now, I think the question for us as a church is, what would it take to weave the gospel story into the fabric of our imaginations such that it becomes the story of our life, such that it becomes the story by which we identify ourselves over any other story that people are inviting us into. What would it take to be a people who rehearse and retell the gospel story in such a way that we never grow tired of it? Because God's mercies are new every morning. Because God has saved us so comprehensively that looking for new ways to live into the adventure of this salvation never ceases to thrill us and amaze us. What would it take to be that type of people? Well, I think the book of Exodus can help us do that. And I hope you'll jump in and begin to see it not only as a true story, not only as a story about God and about Christ, but also as a story that's for you. And that is ultimately about you and God's redemption in your life.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.